everybody. Welcome. Welcome. We're doing something a little different this Sunday. Kevin and I are going to discuss slash argue debate with you. How's that sound? All right. Yes.
You're okay. Cheering for an argument.
You're cheering for an argument. That's exactly right. This is an open question forum kind of situation. So we're going to talk about Ezekiel a little bit, and then we're going to discuss, debate, have a conversation. So for those of you who've been around Spark for a while, we have done this before. I'm out of breath because I was free to run a minute ago. And now I'm free to breathe. Kevin and I have been doing church work together for a long time. We've been doing Spark for almost 13 years. Well, officially since our first Sunday, obviously. We were getting ready a few Sundays before that. And then we've both been doing ministry here in the Bay Area for too long. I think together we have a more than a half a century of experience. So, which is fun.
Does anybody know where I put my cane?
There we go. That's right. And then we're also married. We've been hanging out for a while. So we're not quite, we're getting closer to the 30-year mark. We're in between right now, 25 to 30. I can never remember exactly the right time. That's terrible. How many years?
20. Where's my cane?
yeah, something like that. So one of my favorite personal things in my life to do is to actually come and hang out with Kevin and talk text with Kevin. So it's fortunate that I get to be married to the person that I enjoy talking text with most. You're not the only person I enjoy talking text with, but a lot. So when we were talking about our series of Garden to Garden and Ezekiel, we thought we might turn this particular turn in the middle of our series from Genesis to Revelation into a conversation with everybody here, so we can raise hands and we can shout or wrestle, and mentally, not physically wrestle, and that we could sit and try to have some conversation together. Is there anything you want to add at the top?
Okay.
No, that's it.
Let's go.
All right. So, Ezekiel. We've been talking about how we had prophets to the north and prophets to the south. So we're doing from, Genesis at the very beginning with the garden and everything set to right, and then things go sideways, and you just have to start listening in January to get to where we are now. It's no problem. It's all online. And then we talked about how the Assyrians came and exiled the northern kingdom, which we called Israel, and the southern kingdom, Judah, was able to remain for a little while in the land. But Ezekiel, this book, this prophet, Ezekiel, is going to run into some challenge. Ezekiel is going to start introducing the problem or the conflict with Babylon and how the Babylonian Empire is going to start exiling the southern kingdom. So if you'll remember then, just a quick Cliff Notes version of how we got here, Assyria, that northern warmongering kingdom, conquered and exiled the northern portion of the people of God in 722 BCE. But Jerusalem was able to hold firm for a long time. But then Assyria was conquered by Babylon in 612 BCE. And King Nebuchadnezzar, who we all know because of the book of Daniel, if you'll remember, and we're going to talk about Daniel in a couple weeks, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon sends a force against Jerusalem in 597, takes King Jehoiakim and 10,000 exiles to Babylon, many officials, including the prophet Ezekiel. So they're all taken. So Assyria was in charge, and then now they're not. And here comes the Babylonian Empire. And this is the route that the Judean exiles start. But the exile happens in process. Okay, so it's not like one specific date. It all happened at once. And when we go back to 2 Kings here and we start to read what's happening, it says that in 2 Kings chapter 24, the officers of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, advanced on Jerusalem, laid siege to it. Nebuchadnezzar himself came up to the city while his officers were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and his mother, his attendants, his nobles, his officials all surrendered. In the eighth year of the reign of that king of Babylon, he took King Jehoiakim prisoner. As the Lord had declared, Nebuchadnezzar removed the treasures of the temple of the Lord from the royal palace, cut up the gold articles that Solomon, king of Israel, had made for the temple of the Lord, and he carried all Jerusalem into exile. All the officers, fighting men, the skilled workers, artisans, a total of 10,000. Only the poorest people of the land were left. Now, Ezekiel's of that community that's being taken from Jerusalem to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar takes everyone captive to Babylon. He takes all the prominent people And then he leaves Mattaniah, Jehoiakim's uncle, sort of governor or king in the place, who then changed his name to Zedekiah. Okay?
Can I just say that at some particular point, for those of you who engage with these stories, this is when your brain begins to gloss over.
Yeah.
Because there's so many names that are unfamiliar. Now, if we started this story and I named, let's say a ruler named Zelensky and another ruler named Putin, what would happen to your emotions right now, right? And one of the things that is so difficult sometimes when studying these texts is that those names feel that way to those people, just like the names Putin and Zelensky feel that way to you right now. Or if I said Netanyahu or Sinwar, right? If I said those names now, there's an immediate emotional reaction to what's going on for those of you who are, you know, paying attention to global geopolitics. And one of the things that's fascinating about, one of the reasons why we keep going back to these ancient historical texts is because our faith tradition is deeply contextualized in the global geopolitics of that time and that age. And all of this is really critical information for those folks to say, here's who was in charge, here are the people that were overseeing the religious cultic pieces, these are the people that were overseeing the political pieces, and that is deeply meaningful to them, even though those of us here 2,500, 2,700 years later go,
So what do you
just
mean?
Want to remind you, that that's what's going on, and that's why these texts are so important.
I'm going to just ask you a question. What do you mean by religious cultic pieces? You used the word cult, which we typically use for something that we don't want to be part of.
Yeah, so I don't know if you know this, but you're a part of a cult.
No, say it, make it clear. Don't, that's too long a pause.
This is why she doesn't let me talk very often.
No, it's not true.
For those of you who are new to Spark, we try to use terminologies in their denotative sense, meaning the sense in which the fundamental and formal definitions of the word. We recognize, and I do it intentionally because I'm being snarky and sarcastic, I recognize, but we use those words because it helps to remind us that the ancient peoples and the practices that they were part of are actually not terribly different from the way that we practice. And so when I'm being a little bit provocative in saying that you're a part of a cult, what I simply mean to say is that you are part of a long tradition with liturgies and history and a practice, a faith practice. We just recited the Aaronic benediction, Yevarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, right? That is a prayer that goes back all the way to the 6th century BC that we know of written down. It's like the earliest text that we have. That is a cultic practice, meaning it is a practice that's part of this faith tradition.
Of the religious. And just note, we want to say that word cult is used by academics. And so a lot of times when we have this conversation, it's not typically what you might hear on a Sunday, but Spark is a church where we hold the academic practice of trying to be a bridge between the church and the academy. And a lot of times we find when we go to like the Society of Biblical Literature Conference, and these are the people, like the famous ones that maybe have a little bit of personality to them, your professors, you know, in college, the famous ones might get a PBS special. They might be like interviewed, you know, at Christmas and Easter time, and they use this kind of language. So what we found oftentimes, and you may have found this too in your experience within your faith practice of Christianity, is that the academy is really good at the academy, and the church is really good at the church, and sort of sometimes they don't meet. But we think there needs to be a little more church in the academy, and there needs to be a little more academy in the church. And so when we try to expose you to those words and those terminologies, like this is cultic practice of the time, that's why we're doing it. I think we've derailed, but that's...
Sorry.
Yeah, we're there. Okay. All right. Thank you. 2 Kings continues. Jehoiakim, when he's welcomed, this king of Judah, when he's brought to Babylon, he's given ultimately a seat of honor there. So he gets to put aside his prison clothes. He eats regularly at the king's table for the rest of his life, and he receives an allowance, like you do for a king who's been deposed from another country. And this is important because we care about the line of David. So we want to know that the line of David, where God has made this promised covenant to David, that there will always be one on the throne of the line of David, and there isn't right now in Jerusalem, right? That we're paying attention to that line. So Nebuchadnezzar gave Zedekiah, his uncle, Jehoiakim's uncle, as governor of Jerusalem, but he rebelled. He's like, well, you know what? Let's try to actually get away from Assyria entirely. And so let's go trust Egypt. Fatal error. Babylon lays siege to Jerusalem in 588 BCE. And they are able to hold out for 2 years. You know, imagine what that would be like for 2 years. Jerusalem's not big, friends. It's not big. And so here are the Babylonians. The walls were finally breached in July of 586 BCE, and then the temple is destroyed. And we actually just, this is called the 9th of Av, and this was just celebrated in the Hebrew calendar just this week about the remembrance of the destruction of the temple. Zedekiah then is taken off to Babylon. He's blinded. And Jeremiah, remember that prophet? He's also taken into exile during this time. So all of this is happening as we're reading through the book of Ezekiel. When the exiles are brought through from Jerusalem to Babylon, they're brought to this incredible city. And as they walk through, this is what archaeological illustrators have brought back to life for us to sort of understand what Babylon looked like then. Very impressive. Incredibly impressive. And if you are being taken as prisoner from Jerusalem and had to walk all those many miles, days and months really, from Jerusalem to Babylon. And then you finally, war-torn, and ragged, having been taken captive, refugees, these Jerusalemites are brought into a city that looks like this. Can you start to feel how awe-inspiring that might be? I mean, massive and beautiful, huge gates that they're walking through with statues and animals all along the side. And if you want to know, how do we really know, Danielle, what those gates look like? Well, just go to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin and you can see what archaeologists have brought back and preserved for us. And you can see the close-up of the different animals, how they worked during that time. And even archaeologists discovered in Babylon, which is the modern city of Al-Khalan, Iraq, located on the bank of the Hela branch of the Euphrates River, they found this tablet. It's called the Jehoiakim tablet. It was discovered stored in barrel-vaulted underground building consisting of two rows of rooms near the Ishtar Gate. And it has, this is about the king of Judah that they just took captive. It lists his rations, what he's allowed to have, what rations are set aside for a royal captive, identified as Jeconiah, king of Judah, and its tablets from the royal archives of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, were unearthed in the ruins of Babylon that contained food rations paid to captives, craftsmen who lived in around the city. And on the tablet says, Yahukinu, king of the land of Yahudu, is mentioned along with his five sons who are listed as royal princes. Isn't that amazing that they found this tablet that mentions the king mentioned that was taken captive? And when it says it was found near the Ishtar Gate, just think this. So you are in a land where multiple gods and goddesses are being worshipped, where winged creatures are experienced, where do you see how different this goddess of Ishtar is? I mean, we can start to call out all the different animals that you can start. I mean, those aren't normal person feet, right? And we're finding a lot mixed in. And again, you've been taken captive from your land. You can't worship your God. You're left Jerusalem, and you're encountering huge, incredible architecture. The Etemenaki, I'm not even saying that right, Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth was dedicated to Marduk, and we have the remains of these huge, massive structures that are there. So enter the prophet Ezekiel. He comes from a priestly family, and he expects that he's going to be able to serve in the temple in Jerusalem. But he's deported to Babylon in 597 BCE at the age of 25. He's married. He lives a relatively free existence with the other captives and exiles in Babylon. But 5 years after his exile in Babylon, at the age of 30, when he should have been starting his priesthood, like now I'm 30, I should be in Jerusalem. I should be serving the God of heaven and earth. Ezekiel has the first of a series of visions through which God speaks to him over the next 20 years. And he's commanded to act out some of these visions as messages of the Lord in 12 symbolic acts, more than any other prophet. And in this book, we have 4 visions, 12 symbolic acts, 5 messages, and parables. Now, the first thing that should shock everybody, and I think this is kind of where we're starting to get to some of the meat of what Kevin and I want to discuss, is that Ezekiel is having a vision that God is giving him, but he's not in Israel. He's not in Judah. He's not in Jerusalem. He's having this vision by the banks of the river of this irrigation canal in Babylon. That's crazy. Can God do that? In his utter amazement, he has this crazy vision where it says that the rims were high and awesome and all four rims were full of eyes all around, right? That there's this really weird vision that he has. In fact, earlier today, we were like, what if you typed in Ezekiel's vision into AI Illustrator? I don't know how to do these things. That's why I'm looking at him.
We haven't paid for any modules, so we couldn't actually. We were going to copy in the entire text.
Right. Like, what
Somebody who has actually paid for Gemini or something, go take Ezekiel 1, type it in. We'd love to see what.
It's actually like three. With. As soon as you're like, well, let's just put in this, like winged creatures. No, you've got three more paragraphs of like, and then it was this, and then it was this, and it was doing this, and it was moving like this, and it was like this. And so when we typed it in, they were like, sounds like you're talking about Ezekiel's vision in chapter 1. Like, that's all we got back. We didn't get a picture. So it definitely looked more like this. This really,
really intelligent,
really bizarre winged creature. Like, Ezekiel's having an experience that he can't explain any other way. As we look at the structure of the book, he's going to start to have these oracles at the beginning where he's going to talk about he has words against Israel, he has words against the nations, he has consolation and good news for Israel. In the first 24 chapters, they're going to cover the first 7 years of his ministry in Babylon where he prophesies. Remember, Babylon hasn't fallen entirely. Just the first batch of captives have been taken from Judah. He prophesies that it's going to fall. And when he's doing this, he has to do some weird things we can read about. And then the second portion, he's going to give judgments on Ammon and Moab and Edom and Philistia and Tyre and Sidon and Egypt. And then the last is that he's going to talk about how Jerusalem has fallen, but there's hope. Just one couple more things to set the stage. Ezekiel's audience, people who were exiled with him prior to the destruction of the temple. But then other people are starting to jump in, right? So then people who saw the destruction. And then he's going to start to talk to people who need to get ready to go back. He wants to make sure that people will return. We have a duty to repent. We have a duty to go back and rebuild. And his overwhelming themes is that God's presence is going to be everywhere, whether Jerusalem or Babylon. And he's going to try to explain the events that have been happening before and during and after. And he's going to have some phrases that he likes to talk about a lot. And you're going to notice that if you read the book of Ezekiel this week, he's going to mention the Son of Man 93 times. That's a lot. He's going to talk about how they will know that I am the Lord. Remember, Israel has not obeyed. They've done terrible, terrible things. They've been worshiping Babylonian gods at the temple in Jerusalem. They've been doing awful things. And so all of this whole exile is because God warned them over and over and over again and said, you need to stop. And I need you to know that I am the Lord. Then Ezekiel will say, the oracle, Lord. He'll say, I, the Lord, have spoken. Behold, I am against you. Word of the Lord came to me, and because I'm the Lord. And then this is our favorite. Well, my favorite. Is it yours too? 39 times in Ezekiel, he's going to refer to idols. But the word for idol in Hebrew is gelulim, and it's like dung balls. So you in your text read idol, which sounds way too nice, like tiny little. But Ezekiel's like, you worship poo. Like, that's what he's doing constantly. You are worshiping, like the tiny little balls that come out from the sheep and the goat as they go up the hills and then roll down. That's what you're worshiping. And that's the word Ezekiel's going to use for idol worship the whole time. Gelulim. Now, we just note we have dung beetles up here because there was a god in Egypt called Khepri who was a dung beetle. The face of the god was the dung beetle because, I don't know if you're familiar with the life cycle of dung beetles, but by the way, we really need these dung beetles. Like, if we don't have them, the elephant poop doesn't go anywhere. So you really want these creatures on the face of the earth. But they make this ball at the beginning of the day, and then it rolls, and then it decomposes. And so it's kind of like a creator god, and it's a sun god, and it rises and falls down in the day. And so they saw this dung beetle and what it worshipped as an idol. So he's not just using something out of nothing. Okay, so that's a lot of what Ezekiel is managing and talking about. Do we have any questions so far? Curiosities, wonders. Okay, yes?
Were the listeners receptive?
Were the listeners receptive to Ezekiel? Unlike last week's story, where we talked about the book of Jonah, where Jonah only had to show up and say five words in Hebrew. And everyone's like, got it. And the Assyrians all repented, including their animals. That is not what's happening here. They aren't listening. And as Ezekiel continues to prophesy over and over and over again, people are not listening. So, here's the good news. Yes?
Is this the first time Son of Man comes up, or is that a reference to something prior?
Is the first time Son of Man came up, or is it something that's been mentioned prior?
I'd have to look in Genesis, because man could be Adam, and I'd have to go and check. So the son of Adam?
Ben-Adam.
Ben-Adam. I'd have to go look.
That's yeah, I don't
question.
Know when we would say the first occurrence is. I think it's a great question. When we hear son of man as Christians, we often think it's about Jesus. The word can be used to refer to a messianic figure, but it's not always. It can just mean this man here, Ben-Adam. And in fact, when we're in the land in Israel and then also in the West Bank and leading tours and things like this with our friends, and we have friends throughout that region, and we're praying for peace for the Gazans, for Israelis, for Palestinians, for justice and hope. So I don't say it lightly that we have connections there. We our heart is in the region. But when we're there, Kevin is the... He helps for all the tours by, like, making sure everybody is okay. I get to do, like, the glorious teaching up front, and Kevin goes and takes care of everybody. It's really wonderful. He also does some teaching, too. But what I notice is that our guides and our drivers will often be talking about Kevin, and they'll say in Hebrew, Hu ben Adam. He's the son of Adam. Which is, he's the son of a man. It means he's a good guy. You're a good guy. Yeah.
That's what it means.
Yeah. So it has a multiplicity of meanings. When they're hearing it, it does not necessarily have to be referring to a messianic figure. But you'll see in 2 weeks, when we get to the book of Daniel, if Pastor Omer feels so inclined, because he's the teacher of that book, we will talk about it when we talk about the book of Daniel in what we often refer to as the intertestamental period, but bridging the testament period, that it is used for a messianic phrase there. So it shifts a little bit. You kind of have to look for context to figure out. Like if I said, this is the bomb, you'd need to look for context around to know if I'm talking about something really great or if I'm talking about an explosive device, right? It's the same with Son of Man. Is it just a guy or is it the Messiah? It could really explode your world, or it's just a normal, it's just something good. So here's what I think why we love the book of Ezekiel. Besides the fact that it has very earthy language, Kevin, you like some of the...
Yeah, Ezekiel's one of the books that needs TVMA in front of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, there are some portions, specifically when it gets to the comparative metaphors, the very creative metaphors that Ezekiel uses for the disobedient Israelites, it gets very raunchy very, very quickly. It is not a child's book, my friends.
No, but we'll just cross-stitch some of those verses on the pillows, throw pillows in our kitchen. Just check.
What's your life verse? I'll show you my life.
Right. We'll just hang it out. It's actually an incredibly beautiful book, but it is harsh. And here's... The harsh news. Israel, Judah, they've been exiled. They didn't listen. They didn't change their ways. And now they're stuck in a foreign land.
Can we back up?
Yeah.
Let me ask you.
Yes.
The way that you phrased that just now was causal rather than reflective. So here's what I mean.
Yes.
The way you said that is the reason why they're in exile is because they were disobedient,
yes,
which is what Ezekiel says.
Yes.
Question.
Let's turn this off. Yeah.
Is Ezekiel saying it because it's true, because that is the, or is Ezekiel saying that because that is the reflection, the reflective nature of humanity, say, we got here, how the heck did we get here? And Ezekiel just happens to be the one who goes, I know what happened.
I think that because we already talked about prophets to the north and prophets to the south, Ezekiel's not our only voice. So if Ezekiel were our only voice, we would have to ask that question of like, oh, how is he, you know, hindsight's 20/20. So is he just interpreting the events prior? But we have a lot of prophets shouting from the rooftops before the Assyrians come, before the Babylonians come, get your stuff together. You have broken the covenant over and over and over and over and over again.
Get your dung balls together?
Yeah. Leave those behind, actually. Don't get them together. Like, get away. Right. So the heart-wrenching scene is in Ezekiel chapter 10, where Ezekiel sees in his vision from Babylon that the glory of God, the presence of God that has been living in God's house in Jerusalem has up and departed east. It's gone. That the glory has left God's house. And it's heartbreaking. You're looking at Ezekiel 10 and you're reading through and you just can't believe that this is happening. And it says in verse 18 that the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple. It stopped above the cherubim. And while I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground. And as they went, the wheels went with them. And they stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, to the glory of the Lord of Israel was above them. And these were the living creatures I'd seen beneath the God of Israel by the Kebar River. And I realized they were cherubim. Each had four. And he continues to describe it. And he's like, heartbreaking moment where he sees the destruction of God's house and the departure of God's presence from God's house. And for those of us who've been reading along, remember when God's presence filled the house? It was when Solomon built the house, and it filled it so thick that they couldn't enter in. And now God's presence has left. But the good news is that God's presence went east. God's presence goes east, which is the same direction as the Judeans. As they have been picked up and taken to Babylon, God then picks up God's presence and goes with them into exile. And this is like mind-boggling, crazy.
Why?
Because there is no other deity that we know of in the ancient Near Eastern world at all that wasn't tied to a place. There were gods of the waters, gods of the deserts. There's the gods of Assyria. There's the gods of Egypt. There's the gods of Babylon. And so that's the god there. And the Babylonians came and they won. So that god's now defeated. That Jerusalemite god, that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh god, that god's gone. It doesn't matter anymore. Because that place for that god and that people for that god and the, watch this, cultic religious practices of that people and that God in Jerusalem are no more. And remember, do they have their own version of a Gelulim? They don't, right? Israelites don't have that because it says in Deuteronomy, we saw no form. So the only thing that they have that's an indicator that God is with us is the filling of God's presence in that house. And Ezekiel sees it leave, but it leaves to go with us into exile. And that's crazy.
Exile is one of the most important themes, I think, that we don't understand fully, because many of us, if we were born or raised in this particular location, or maybe even traveled, we did so because of migration or because of moving or jobs or whatever. This sense of exile is you've got pulled out of what was home. And you are now in a place that is completely foreign to you. And exile is not only just a historical theme, it's actually a motif amongst the entire scriptures, all the way even through the New Testament. Excuse me. And exile could be, I thought I knew what life was and is, and then all of a sudden something happens and it's no longer the thing that you thought it was. And that's kind of the visceral nature of exile playing itself out in our day. Exile could be a marriage that doesn't end the way that you thought it was going to end up. It could be death or disease. It could be tragedy. It could be the loss of a job. It could be a sense of identity change where you thought you knew what home is. And then that event happens, biblically speaking, you are now in exile. I don't know what's up. I don't know what's down. I thought I knew how this was going to play out. And then all of a sudden, it's not playing out.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Danielle keeps talking about, this idea of God going into exile, the theme of a deity being located in a particular place is the, as Danielle said, is the predominant motif, the predominant way theology that you see the God. So, in fact, we kind of do this sometimes in our modern day. When things are good, God is here. Then when things are bad, that's when all the questions, like, where is God, right? We don't ever ask where is God when things are good and prosperous. So even though we've abstracted that idea into our religious practice, we do the exact same thing. We have located God in a particular sense of home, sense of experience, a sense of reality,
order.
A sense of order.
Yeah.
And what this is now, wait a second, when that order gets
disrupted.
Demolished, disrupted,
deconstructed.
Yeah. Now we're stuck in, like, well, I don't even know where God is. And what this story, I think what we're attempting to communicate is what this story suggests, what Ezekiel suggests, is that actually God is going with you. Yes, Yahweh has left that location. It's no longer home. It's no longer familiar. It's no longer the place that you thought you knew so well, where you felt home. So now you're somewhere else. And this story suggests that this new place that you're in exile, you're in a foreign place, unknown, uncertain, scared. Yahweh is just as present here as God was there.
Yeah, that's crazy. And Ezekiel has this vision of God leaving in 10, Ezekiel chapter 10. But very, very quickly in Ezekiel 11, we hear this. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Although I sent them far away among the nations and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. God, and remember in the beginning when Solomon dedicates that the house for God, do you remember what he says? I'll make this house for you, but of course you can't live in a house. Of course, you're God of everything. You don't live here. What house made of human hands could you ever live in? So that theology that God is bigger than any particular place or building has been there, but now they're living it in a different way, right? Here they have chapter 11, verse 16. Yet for a little while, I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. And then this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will gather you back from the nations. I will bring you back from the countries where you've been scattered. And I will give you back the land of Israel again. They will return to it. And this time they'll remove all the Galilim, the vile images, detestable gods, and I'll give them an undivided heart. I'll put a new spirit in them. I will remove from them their heart of stone. I will give them a heart of flesh, and then they will follow my decrees and be careful to follow to keep my laws. They will be my people. I will be their God. And then he proceeds on. And then the glory of the Lord goes up from within the city, stops above the mountain east of it, and the spirit of the Lord lifts Ezekiel up and brings him back to the exiles in Babylon. I don't know if we can really appreciate, like, if you've been taken captive, if you're a refugee and you aren't home, you're holding out hope that some turn might happen, that you're going to get to go back. And so for a while, for the first portion of Ezekiel's life there, for the first 5 to 7 years, he's like, maybe this thing's going to turn around, right? They're treating the king okay. They're giving him some food, right? He's got an allowance. Maybe he can save his allowance. We'll get to go back, right? Like, maybe something will happen. But once Jerusalem's destroyed, that hope gets crushed. There is no place to go back to anymore. And this is when God says to Ezekiel, you still get a vision. And guess what? I'm going with you, and I will be with you, and I will be a sanctuary for you. I will be that house for you there. Which is crazy. If you know people who have been displaced, which is happening more and more these days, if you see people who are being taken from homelands or places they've only known to call home and being forcibly removed and sent somewhere else, if you know people who have been forcibly taken from family, from friends, from place or space or state or country or nationality or language, or from the place of rights and citizenship, if you know people who have been incarcerated, if you know people who've been pushed out of homes and systems, if you're sitting in this place and you've been pushed out of those homes and systems, the book of Ezekiel says to you and to me, you are not alone. God is with you. God goes with you. God is in the prison. God is on the other side of that border. God is in the holding cell. God is not far. God is close. So the book of Ezekiel is asking the question, where is God when things are hard? When it seems like nothing makes sense? God is with us. We have a God who says, have you disobeyed? Do you deserve all that is going to happen to you? Have you broken all of the covenant that I kept my side perfectly and you broke all of it? And now you deserve to be displaced because you have to learn this lesson. We have to resort, deconstruct, reconstruct, or reorder, whatever it is. Guess what? There's grace and there's mercy. I'll go with you. And God goes with us.
And as a result of that truth and that teaching, the faith of Israel is encouraged to be strengthened and fortified, even though their location is difficult. I would encourage us to consider that strengthening and fortification of your faith found in Ezekiel's very name. There's this phrase in Joshua where they say, be strong and courageous. And there's a phrase actually in Hebrew, chazak, chazak, venit, chazek, which means be strong, and strengthen one another. And if you listen to that word, chazak, and then you think of what is, how do you say God's name in Hebrew? One of the first names in Hebrew is Elohim, so you take that first L. So anytime you see a name that says has L in it, it's got the name of God. So at chazak, el, it is God is strengthening you. The very name of the prophet, it exudes this kind of idea that in the midst of exile, in the face and the reality of exile, your faith and your hope and your belief in the coming of Eden is strengthened.
Amen. And I think the question is, can we find sweetness in the midst of bitterness? And when we look at the very beginning of Ezekiel, it says that he sees his hand stretched out to him, and in it was a scroll, which, you know, the messenger angel of God is unrolling before. And on both sides were written, both sides, people, words of lament, mourning, and woe. And Ezekiel eats it, because God tells him to do it. Son of man, eat this scroll I'm giving you and fill your stomach. And I ate and it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. And it's a call to us, like, how do we find sweetness in the midst of bitterness and challenge? And Ezekiel is going to even have to live a life very difficult. He's going to act out these stories. He becomes this kind of weird street, prophetic street performer where on the side of the road, he's going to be like, let me build up Jerusalem. Let me knock it down. And then he's going to have to actually pretend to be the scapegoat at one point, lying on his side. And God is going to tell him to eat the food that is being baked over human excrement. And then Ezekiel will say what Peter says later in the book of Acts, like, I've never eaten anything unclean. So then God's like, okay, no problem. You can eat over cow excrement. I'm not sure that's better.
It's an upgrade.
Right. And so Ezekiel is practiced at trying to find some what's...
Sorry, I just... My yes. brain went... I'll have the poo-poo platter, please.
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, my bad.
So the book of Ezekiel tells us that exile happens, that excrement happens. But then that exegesis happens, that you have to sort of study your text and try to reorient and go, oh, okay, but God is still with me here. God is not held to only a place or only a building. But lastly, and this is the hope, Eden happens. When you get to the end of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel has another vision. This is the very last bit. And he has a vision that Jerusalem, that the place where God puts God's name, has been restored. That the temple is bigger and wider, and it's a crazy description. You have to go through it here in Ezekiel 47. And then he sees a river of water flowing out from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple facing east. And the water's coming down from the south side of the temple, from the altar, and it goes down through the Kidron Valley, and it's going to actually head all the way out from Jerusalem towards the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea. And the water is so powerful, it turns that sea fresh. And the trees along the banks become good for the healing of the nations. Where the river flows, everything will live. Fishermen will stand along the shore from En Gedi to En Engleim, and there'll be places for spreading nets. There was no fish. There's still no fish in the Salt Sea or Dead Sea. They can't live. It's too salty. And Ezekiel's like, there will be a time when all of this gets set back to right. And this bit of hope, and I was reading a book earlier this afternoon with my daughter, and it said, hope is like a hook that catches you and can't let you go. The hope of Eden, even as they are exiled, is imbued in everything they're doing, in every moment, that even while in exile, when it seems all hope is lost, Eden is still promised. That this book, of all the books we're talking about, and I'll probably say this a few more times, this book is really garden to garden. This book talks about how the land of Israel was to have been our Eden, our garden, where we were going to live with God's presence, etc. Ever since Eden itself, when we were kicked out, God has been trying to get us back into the garden, back into right relationship with him, where we aren't exiled. That's the first exile, right? And this book is telling us that even when we're far, even when we've been displaced, God is bringing us back. Right. Amen. So, friends, all of us who live in exile together here in this place, we aren't far from God, are we? God dines with us, sups with us, and the table is right here in our midst. And this is our reminder that God is not far off, and that God still sets a table for us, even as we live far from him in exile. For the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. All are welcome at this table.